Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm as well, live link to the trumpet.com. Coming up on today's program, a look at the headlines at the trumpet.com, some really interesting stories to look at. Also, a preview of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's coming your way today. A really interesting survey. Most millennials, turns out they like to text more than talk face-to-face. Which one's better? Which one's more effective? That and more stories coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. This is Trumpet Radio Live on Thursday, 101.3 KPCG. We're online a couple of places, kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And as a reminder, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Any emails you'd have that you might want to send along, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm, and we're happy to take a look at those for you. Dwight Falk with you here today. Grant Turgeon will be back here in a few days, but solo for a few days here on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. The top story there, something very interesting that I think a lot of people have been following for many years. Europe's push toward a unified military. That's by Richard Palmer. As global threats increase, many nations support the idea of an independent and united European military. Here is why we expect it to happen and where we expect it to lead. Make sure you stop and check that out. Lots of people there when you put Europe all together, all the nations, and lots of military potential. Not probably thought of as a real military power over the last, since World War II, I suppose. But they are growing in strength there. And, of course, if you remember your history, after World War II, they were not supposed to ever militarize again. And but it looks like it's heading that way. So that's becoming something where when the World War II memories are fading and it's becoming further back in history, some of the things that were discussed at that time in terms of keeping Europe away from being a military power seem to be forgotten. And so there's a push toward a unified military there in Europe. Really important story. Check that out at thetrumpet.com. And, of course, comes from the Edstone branch over there, which is right in that Europe area, and has a really good ground-level view of what's happening. That's the top story today at thetrumpet.com. Also, another headline that's pretty interesting. You can find it at thetrumpet.com. It pulls from the BBC. The article is Young and in the Red, Personal Debt. And so that's something that is a major concern in many nations, and this one focuses on some of what's going on in the UK, but it's pretty indicative of a lot of the Western nations. It says borrowing on loans, overdrafts, credit cards, and car finance has accelerated since 2011. Of course, in 2008, I think many of us recall the Great Recession, as it was. The global markets in the world were faltering and falling, and there were cracks in that foundation of global finance. Really quite concerning. Very close to a complete global economic meltdown was, I guess, somewhat avoided, or the can was kicked down the road, as the expression goes. But the numbers now in debt have increased since 2011. There's about a three-year window there where I think people got more serious about getting rid of debt, realized some of the problems that would bring, could bring, the catastrophe it could bring. But now it seems like people have relaxed and are getting back into debt. That's what the BBC shows. And one of the reasons that, or some of the things people are getting into debt into, is a consumer credit that remains very high. Credit cards and the like, those numbers are increasing as far as the debt goes. PCP agreements have increased fivefold since 2008. This is a term that you may not be as familiar with. It is a personal contract purchase. That's what the PCP stands for. It says one reason for this trend is the fashion for the personal contract purchase agreements when buying a car. This product imported from the United States effectively means borrowers rent the car and the monthly payments cover the depreciation of its value over time. And of course, that still counts as a loan. I guess that would be very similar to a lease. Maybe it's just another term for that. But those have increased quite a bit. They're referred to as PCP here. This is focusing, again, on a lot of what's happening in the UK, but there's a lot of relation to what comes from the United States. And those numbers have really increased there, these personal contract purchases on cars. So that's another big area where people get into a lot of debt. And if you've noticed, cars are very expensive. They don't seem to be getting any cheaper. They're getting more and more expensive. And, of course, there was a time right after 2008 when people were getting rid of their Suburbans and their bigger vehicles, and they wanted to save money on gas, and now it kind of seems like it's going the other way. Particularly here in the United States, some other nations maybe are a little more into some of the electric-type vehicles or the hybrids, and there's a fair number of those here in the United States as well, but still lots of big vehicles on the road. Not that that's good, bad, or otherwise, but they are expensive for sure. They're all expensive. And so habits of consumers changed somewhat, even in the car market after 2008, but it seems like it's kind of people have forgotten about that and are moving on now with more and more debt in that field, in that area. Another way that people are getting into debt is balance transfer deals. They have gotten longer. If you have a credit card, no doubt you get these offers all the time. I certainly do. Another signal, they say, of the greater availability of credit over time is the competition between credit card companies over the 0% balance transfer deals. This is, of course, where you use one credit card to pay off another one, and you have a 0% interest rate for the duration of the term. It allows the borrower to use that new credit card to pay off the old debt. And the length of time that the amount borrowed is interest-free has been increasing, years sometimes. And the difficulty with that, of course, is probably a couple of them. In some ways, it can be a smart tool, but one of the difficulties is that it can give the false impression that financial progress is being made, even though it's just shifting the debt. And the other thing is failing to meet a repayment deadline can leave people in a serious spiral of debt, according to this report here from the BBC. The Bank of England has also expressed concern that people are shifting their debts around, not paying them off. And then, of course, if you miss a payment or something happens, those rates jump very, very quickly. It can be a real trap. So that's another area where debt has been increasing since 2011. Again, about a three-year respite there between 2008 and 2011. And now these debts are jumping again. And finally, it says the young are more likely to buy essentials on credit. All this has left some young people with serious concerns that they will struggle to pay off debts. This report here from the BBC is focusing more on the younger generation, but of course this affects a lot of people. They say some campaigners say that the availability of credit, alongside a squeeze in wages, has led young adults in some cases to turn more readily than the older generation to credit to buy day-to-day essentials. One in five 25 to 34-year-olds admitted doing this in the past 6 months, according to the research, compared with 6% of the over 55s. So those that are older probably are in a little better shape financially, hopefully they are, and they're not turning to credit for essentials, but some of the younger people are doing that. So that's a real debt crisis that somebody can get into, a real spiral, if they're having to buy day-to-day essentials on credit. So that's an interesting write-up. There's a lot more to that. It is a headline you can find at thetrumpet.com. It's from the BBC. Young and in the red, personal debt, and they have a few charts here that explain why there is so much of that debt. Bad situation. Funny how quickly people forget. 2008, that was a lot of people got in trouble there financially, and but when things settle down a little bit, it's easier to not think about it so much. There's some great write-ups at thetrumpet.com about finance, some good booklets you can get, two in particular that are there at The Trumpet that are free, The Financial Law That You Can't Afford to Ignore, and Solve Your Money Troubles. You can find those at thetrumpet.com. Those are free booklets. And if you have, you know, money issues. You can't beat a free booklet. And even if you don't, it's always good to get something for free if you can. So those are really good write-ups. They can help out a lot. And you can find those at thetrumpet.com. Also, make sure you stop and check out the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host, Stephen Fleury. Replay comes up here throughout the day a few times. You can find the schedule of programming online at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. And also, a lot of people like to download the archives, and you can get those from those websites as well. And listen to them later on your commute or whatever. Lots of people like to do that, put it on their smart device, and listen to those programs. Today, he talks about a few topics, including Herbert W. Armstrong's impact on the Philippines. He did quite a bit over in that area, if you're familiar with his work and what he did traveling internationally to different places, including the Philippines. And Mr. Stephen Fleury was just over there recently, and so has a lot of good insight there about what Mr. Armstrong did and his impact on the Philippines. Also, another part of the program, some comments are made about the mass shooting in Las Vegas. That seems like a long time ago already. I guess it's been a few weeks, but really not long in when you think about it. Yet the attention span of people in general is pretty short today, and there's always new headlines and new topics coming out. So it's easy to kind of forget about this, but that was the biggest mass shooting in U.S. history. Lots of good programs about that, Trumpet Daily radio shows that you can find talking about that shooting. Go back and look at those if you've missed them. But some comments about that today. And this is an interesting story. It's related to that. Terrorism insurance is in demand for concerts following the Las Vegas attack. And so this is in relation to the artists that are performing. I don't know if people can get individual insurance for something like that. Maybe they could if they were the concert goer. But when a artist is putting on a concert and it's a big concert and they're a big artist, now they need terrorism insurance because there's a potential of being attacked at their concert, as crazy as that is. It says, if it's a big tour and you're a high-profile artist and you gather tens of thousands of people per show, you have to have it now, it says. That's according to an attorney who represents pretty high-profile acts, including Britney Spears and Steven Tyler. This write-up says, political violence and terrorism, PVT for short, insurance policies have been available for decades, but they have been a tough sell unless artists are touring in volatile regions like South America or Eastern Europe. So depending on where the tour would go, they may want to get this PVT insurance, political violence and terrorism. But again, it's, you know, it costs money, so people are trying to make as much as they can and not shell out for this insurance. And if you're touring in the United States years ago or in the West, you wouldn't think you'd need something like this. But of course, times are changing. And we have seen quite a few attacks at concerts recently, any place where there's a gathering of people, sadly. And so now there's an insurance for that. And it's been around, but again, now people are starting, these big acts and these artists are needing to carry it. It says, after the killing of 58 concert goers in Las Vegas that took place while Jason Aldean was on stage, the bombing outside the Ariana Grande show in Manchester, England in May, and the 2015 attack on the Bataclan nightclub in Paris, reps are now advising talent agents to buy the coverage no matter where they tour. They say not everybody believes it's necessary, but it's getting to be more and more that way, according to Bill Tannenbaum. He's a business manager who specializes in representing touring artists. He said, I'm pretty vocal about taking it with my clients, and luckily, we had it with Ariana Grande. The singer canceled multiple stops on her tour after the attack before returning to Manchester for a benefit concert. Standard non-performance insurance costs about 2% of the artist's guarantee and pays a claim, usually about 80% of appearance fees, if shows are canceled for reasons like illness, injury, or natural disaster. A PVT add-on costs about an extra 0.5%. So this is basically, if you're going on tour as an artist, there's money to be made, but it costs a lot of money to put the tour together as well. So this is where typically the money would go, and for a hypothetical 6-week, 30-date U.S. tour. The artist is going to get $4 million, roughly. That's their guarantee for putting on these 30 shows. $1.4 million goes to commission fees. Production costs are usually about $800,000. Travel and equipment transportation is $600,000. Rehearsal costs, $500,000. Salaries and per diem pay, $280,000. Three personal security guards, $90,000. Standard non-appearance insurance is $80,000, and then the terrorism insurance is $20,000. So no matter what's happening in the world, it seems like there is an insurance for that. And now more artists, when they go out on tour, even in the West, are having to get this PVT add-on, costing them roughly $20,000 if they were going on a 30-date U.S. tour. And again, that PVT insurance is for political violence and terrorism. So maybe insurance is a good business to get into. I don't know. But, of course, insurance makes money when they don't have to pay out too much. And in the case of concerts and so forth, they're having to pay out more and more. And it's just a sad state of affairs here in the U.S. And in the West. And you think about how much money gets, you could say, wasted in some cases because of the threat of some sort of, you know, human evil occurring, where if people weren't doing those things, well, there'd be more money in everybody's pocket. But that's the world we live in. So interesting there. And again, there's more about that Las Vegas attack at thetrumpet.com, quite a bit more that you can look at. And it's kind of dropped out of the main headlines, I guess. You see a story here and there about it, but attention spans, you know, are short and things move on, and there's more stories out there about different topics. But that was still a huge, huge event. And there's some more about that on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. So make sure you listen for that with your host, Stephen Fleury. Quite a few topics talked about today. Here's an interesting survey that I think will ring true for many people. It says most millennials, Generation Z adults, prefer texting over talking in person. Not surprising. How many text messages do you think you send per day or per week? Yeah, it's probably quite a few. I was in the airport just a few days ago, and I saw somebody walk by me, a younger person, I think, and they were texting on their phone. They'd just gotten off the flight. And so when people get off their flights, they want to catch up on all their communication-related updates, whether it's texting or emails or whatever else. And I was surprised because this young lady was walking, looking straight ahead, and she was texting very, very quickly on her phone without looking at it. And I thought, wow, she must be really, really good with the small keyboard or trust the autocorrect. Not sure, but I haven't seen that too often, but she was pretty quick with her phone. Lots of people like the texting and like other forms of communication like that. A new survey finds that 7 in 10 millennials and the younger Generation Z, that's the new generation, I guess, prefer, is it the last generation? Why is it Generation Z? Interesting title. But they prefer to communicate digitally, mostly by text message, than in person. Researchers at LivePerson, which is a business solution provider, polled more than 4,000 young adults between ages 18 and 34 in a handful of Western nations, helping them discover the priorities and preferences of today's millennials and Generation Z. So there's always a marketing consideration there, I guess. You got to find out what people like. Globally, they say 65% of those surveyed indicated they talk to peers more frequently via texting on a mobile, but that number is even higher in English-speaking nations. In both the United States and in the UK, about 74% of millennials and Generation Z communicate digitally more frequently than with others face-to-face. As for the tool of choice for digital correspondence, about 73% of Americans and 74% of those in the UK prefer text messaging. That number dipped to about 69% globally. But no matter where you are, if the ability to text is provided or it is there, most people like to do that. Nearly 70% of the group surveyed said they could see a future in which all purchases are made online, and most young consumers prioritized using technology when they needed assistance with a product or a service, which is very much the case today. And it's kind of interesting. I was recently on a trip and conversing with a shop owner. I was in their shop, and she was probably in her 50s, I would guess. And we were kind of laughing about how not too long ago, if you were going to take a trip somewhere, you would contact AAA and you could order a triptych. I don't know if you remember that. But it would send you this this small little packet, and it would have the maps for where you wanted to go. So you could plot your course on your trip. And or you contact a travel agent or something like that to arrange details, or call an airline to talk to a person about finding flights. Doesn't happen that way very often anymore. Most times, you know, you just do everything online without speaking to anyone. In some cases, you can almost check in, get on a flight almost without talking to somebody. You do have security, I guess, and a few things like that. But and even with navigation, I can't recall the last time I navigated with a map. A physical map. It's always now, you know, the GPS on a smart device. So it's amazing how things have changed that way. But specifically in relation to communication, now people are not wanting to even speak face to face in a lot of cases, preferring to actually communicate digitally. Is it the most effective way to communicate? It's an interesting question. It's very convenient. There's no doubt about that. I think we like the convenience. But there's good evidence out there, I think, that actually speaking face-to-face is more effective and more productive. This is a write-up from Forbes magazine. This is from March 11th, 2016. And the title is The Immeasurable Importance of Face-to-Face Meetings. This is related to work in particular. And I know if somebody has a lot of meetings, it can kind of drag on and on, it seems like, at times. But they say these are more effective in a lot of cases. This is according to Michael Mazzari. He believes that face-to-face interaction is and will continue to be the most effective form of communication. He is Caesars Entertainment Senior Vice President of National Meetings and Events. So he's always having meetings and events. That's his job. And he says, no matter what industry you work in, we are all in the people business. Regardless of how tech-savvy you may be, face-to-face meetings are still the most effective way to capture the attention of participants, engage them in the conversation, and drive productive collaboration. If we don't continue to nurture strong and positive personal relationships with our clients and coworkers, we won't build trust, understanding, or a sense of a shared mission, all of which are critical elements to successful partnerships and business success. That's what he thinks anyway, and has some good experience in the field. So again, and like he points out, no matter what industry we work in, really it is a people business, because man, that's a, if a person is selling a product, they're selling it to a person. And almost no matter what we do have to have good personal relationship ability. And texting doesn't really help with that, I guess. Harvard Business Review says this: a face-to-face request is 34 times more successful than an email. So if you're emailing people looking for some sort of an answer or some sort of help, you know, some people are really good. They'll get back to you right away. Other people don't check their emails that often. But according to this study from the Harvard Business Review, a face-to-face request is 34 times more successful than an email, which is much better. Despite the reach of email, they say, asking in person is the significantly more effective approach. You need to ask 6 people in person to equal the power of a 200 recipient email blast. Still, most people tend to think the email ask will be more effective. And so that's an those are interesting statistics. Emailing 200 people, or a list of 200 people, not as or only equal, they say, to asking in person 6 people. So it's easier to send out the email, I guess, but not as effective. They say if your office runs on email and text-based communications, it's worth considering whether you could be a more effective communicator by having conversations in person. It is often more convenient and comfortable to use text-based communication than to approach someone in person, But if you overestimate the effectiveness of such media, they say, you may regularly and unknowingly choose inferior means of influence. And they also point out that you don't get a very good reading on a person, obviously, if you're not looking at them. Or you could misconstrue what somebody means, or you know, their intent or their tone. It's hard to gather that information from a text or from an email. And so if it's an important meeting or it's a request that you really want fulfilled, oftentimes it's better to have face-to-face conversations. But those are getting to be more rare now, as this new data suggests. So pretty interesting to see the change in technology and the way that it changes people's interactions with each other. And the more and more people grow up with texting and email and whatever the next form of communication will be, it'll be interesting to see how they relate to others. We're more connected than ever with some of these means of communication, and yet we're more divided than ever and lonelier than ever, I think, according to a lot of research you can find. So it's interesting to see how those two, or how technology affects things in different ways. More people using the technology, being more communicated, yet being more isolated in a lot of ways. So kind of interesting information there. One other thing I wanted to mention, really important trumpet brief that was sent out. They're always really good and very effective means of getting the trumpet's message across. And if you haven't signed up for that, it's free. You can get it at thetrumpet.com. You can just go there and sign up for that. It's a free email. And get sent to your inbox a few times a week at least. And it's pretty short. You can get through it pretty quickly. Packed with a lot of good information and very, very relevant to current affairs and what's going on. And the trumpet brief that came out yesterday, go back and look at it if you haven't had a chance. Or again, if you don't have the service, sign up for it. The title is What the Harvey Weinstein Scandal Teaches Us About America. If you've turned on the headlines at all, you cannot escape this story. It is everywhere, even if you haven't looked at all the details of it. But it is probably the most prevalent story here the last week or so. And Joel Hilliker writes this in this trumpet brief. It says, one of entertainment's most powerful men, Harvey Weinstein, stands exposed as a serial womanizer and a brazen pervert, a fitting symbol of a corrupt industry. In not unrelated news, a few weeks ago, pornographer Hugh Hefner died and was widely eulogized as a cultural revolutionary, a valiant conqueror of sexual repression. These regrettable headlines, he writes, reveal the sick state of American morality. So you're going to see a lot about these particular story with Harvey Weinstein all over the place. As a matter of fact, the latest Time magazine that I have has him on the cover looking pretty ominous. And the title or the cover story is Producer Predator Pariah. And so they really go after him quite a bit in this edition of Time. And, of course, a lot of news sites are doing the same sort of thing and really piling on. But what they're not talking about very much is one of the most important aspects of the story, which is brought out in the trumpet brief, which is the sick state of American morality. This is kind of being put up there like it's this situation, like it's a problem with one individual or maybe several individuals, or even they might go as far to break it down between men and women. I've seen a lot of write-ups that are doing that and making it a men versus women sort of situation there with Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, a feminist type issue. But what about the sick state of American morality in general? I mean, again, this is Hollywood. That's they produce the movies that that are in the theaters and that make it to other places as well. And we haven't heard a lot about that, but the trumpet brief really gets to the heart of that important point here in this Harvey Weinstein situation. Joel Hilliker continues and says, few would acknowledge it, but there is a link between these episodes and the spate, you're talking about the Harvey Weinstein situation, and the spate of curses besieging America lately. And think about what we've had. As he mentions, the list here, hurricanes, wildfires, mass shootings, political chaos, social fragmentation, and so on. And again, even this Weinstein situation is more social fragmentation. And he says there are far more directly, they sorry, rather, these are far more directly the cause for such effects than our global warming, inadequate gun control, or systematic racism. And so people are looking for causes for the problems that they see and kind of pointing at these well, I don't know what you call them, nebulous causes such as global warming or, you know, gun control or things like that, instead of looking at the morality of America, the law. Are we following the law of God in America? That's a question that's not being asked. The Trumpet brief continues and says Weinstein had been at his gross escapades for decades. And, of course, more and more details are coming out about that. He targeted dozens of women. Many acquiesced to his salacious demands, and many more to his threats to keep quiet, fearing harm to their careers. Everyone, Mr. Hilliker writes, is piling on Mr. Weinstein. Suddenly, everyone is appalled. Politicians who accepted millions of his dollars are acting disgusted and shocked. But Weinstein's behavior was no secret. Everyone knew. Employees around him helped. Untold numbers, including his political connections, they looked the other way. His sins were condoned and nurtured within the field, within the fetid incubator that is America's entertainment industry. He thrived with a vast system of complicity. Just a really good word picture there. I mean, it the fetid incubator that is American entertainment industry. And it is. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of movies lately. Maybe a kids movie here or there, quote unquote, and sometimes those aren't the best. But you see the previews, you know, occasionally on television or somewhere. And it's just the depths of depravity, some of these things. And it's not just the movies. It can be on television. It can be on Netflix, whatever the case might be. And so here we have this great irony, right, between condemning a person who has done horrible deeds, but then looking at the movies that were made, not just by him, but by others, and that they portray the same thing that he did, and they glamorize it, and yet people think that's fine. That's the hypocrisy, and it's not being talked about much in the media. It is being talked about here in this Trumpet brief, and it's really an important one to look at. Continuing in this Trumpet brief, he says, pretending like Weinstein was an anomaly in Hollywood is as phony as a styrofoam movie prop. Weinstein was abetted by a casting couch culture, so-called, that has pervaded the industry from its earliest days. So this sort of thing goes on, apparently. Scripture, and I'll notice this point, Scripture condemns not only the thief, but also the person who consents with him. Not only the adulterer, but also the one who keeps company with him. That's in Psalm 50 and verse 18. Even in the legal system in the U.S., and I think probably other countries too, you know, a person can be guilty of a crime even if they didn't commit it, but they were, you know, complicit in it. They were there, they drove the car, or whatever happened. They're guilty as well. He says, nobody can be genuinely shocked at this man's immorality. Hollywood glamorizes immorality. That this powerful producer, whose movies have made billions of dollars and garnered dozens of prestigious film awards, could commit these sexual crimes for so long highlights the nature of the people he mixed with and the product he peddled. I mean, he sold his, you know, what he was doing in his personal life. The movies were made about it, you know, not directly, but the same sort of activities, and sold and made a lot of money doing it. This Trumpet brief says, over and again, this kind of private vice is made public. It's scripted, acted, filmed, polished, distributed, projected, broadcast, and streamed worldwide. How can society suddenly condemn his actions, which are justifiably condemnable, yet not recognize the problem with the films that disseminate this culture far and wide? If you think back to one of the famous quotes from Russia, might have been Khrushchev, I can't remember exactly, but they said that they feared America morally because of all the evil that comes out, particularly from Hollywood. They were afraid of what it was going to do to their nations and to their people, and lots of nations would feel that way because of what we glamorize coming out of Hollywood. In the Trumpet brief, it says, how is a secluded solicitation, worse than one that is recorded and circulated. It is ridiculous to believe society can freely enjoy the latter without having to deal with the former as an ugly consequence. There's a quote here from this most recent Time that I thought was interesting. Again, it has Harvey Weinstein on the cover looking pretty ominous, producer, predator, pariah. And the writer of this particular piece, a lady for The New Yorker, says this. The only plea I would make in the aftermath of Weinstein's downfall, a victory that's both wretched and sweet, considering how many people have been hurt along the way, is not to turn against the movies themselves. So that's what you hear from a lot of the media, and I've seen a couple of write-ups like this, and there may be, I'm sure there's more out there. So again, they're saying, well, he was a terrible guy, and he did terrible things, but don't turn against the movies. The movies are good. The author says, in the days after the Weinstein story broke, I noticed a number of young women on social media fretting that movies they had loved growing up, and they list a few titles, now seem tainted. Could they ever bear to enjoy them again? Says, but to reject the movies themselves amounts to punishing the victim. It undercuts the fine work that so many women and decent men have put into Weinstein-produced movies over the years. The ugly reality that some of those women were working under duress makes their contribution and their fortitude even more admirable. So, and now again, some of the titles they list off, movie titles, they may not be the worst movie ever made, of course. There might be some redeeming quality there. I don't know much about some of them. But there's certainly a lot of terrible ones that are out there. And even these that are listed, the little I do know about them, I'm pretty sure there's some pretty bad scenes in quite a few of them. And so, but they're saying here, hey, don't turn against the movies themselves. But that's a big part of the problem, that the culture is glorified, the make believe, as it were, the glamorized version. It's made to look great, these sins, and yet when they're done in real life, then people are appalled by it. But yet the culture glorifies the movies themselves. If you look at the top grossing movies from 1995 to 2017, you'll see something kind of interesting. The top grossing movies are PG-13 rated, which there's a lot of PG-13 movies that aren't very good, but they're considered a little more in the middle. And so those are the top grossing. Those are the most, they make the most money on those for pretty obvious reasons. They can probably pull in the largest audience from all age groups into those types of movies. But they've produced far more R-rated movies. Far more. Almost twice as many in that time period from 1995 to 2017. PG-13 movies, they made 2,828. They made 4,781 R movies. It doesn't even make sense financially. Matter of fact, there's a whole write-up I found about that. Well, they said, well, why would Hollywood not make more middle-of-the-road movies that make more money? And they had some ideas about, well, they can sell more videos, and they think maybe they make their money back later in some ways, but they still want to push the boundaries. Now, the author was saying, well, you know, it's art and that type of thing. But they're, in a lot of cases, they're pushing perversion. Even though they make more money with PG-13 movies, they produce almost twice as many R-rated movies. And then PG movies and G movies, those are way down on the list. They don't make many of those. And not included in this list, too, is how many not rated movies are made, which, again, not rated typically means it's going to be on the worst scale of things. Maybe it's a foreign film or something like that. And they've made a lot of those as well. The most movies were they made 4,795 not rated films and 4,781 R-rated films between 95 and 2017, according to these statistics. So even though the money is in the more tame movies, they still make far more of the bad movies. It's unbelievable. If you look at IDBM, which looks at some of the film industry, and you look at the list of the most popular movies in 2016 that have graphic sex scenes in them, there's a list of 164 titles. That's how many movies in 2016 were made. And those are just the most popular ones, 164 that have pretty graphic scenes in them. So how can the culture in the U.S. Justify this? How can people justify this where those movies are being produced, they're being made, they're being watched on some level, and that's not being condemned, but the person that's actually producing a lot of the films and is doing the the perverted acts himself, he is being condemned now. So it is just really interesting to look at that. It's something the media just hasn't talked about very much, and so it's really, really good to get this trumpet brief and see that, be exposed for what it is. I mean, it is rank hypocrisy, and it does need to be exposed, and it is being exposed in some write-ups like the trumpet brief, but really, I haven't seen it anywhere else, because I think you can imagine sort of the outcry if somebody started questioning the movies. There would be an outcry against it. This trumpet brief concludes and says, a lot of people are getting a self-righteous charge out of condemning one movie producer right now. The Motion Picture Academy booted him and said, quote, the era of willful ignorance and shameful complicity in sexually predatory behavior and workplace harassment in our industry is over. We'll see, Mr. Hilliker writes. But don't expect the product to change. Romans 1 condemns those who, rejecting God, take on a reprobate mind and become filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, maliciousness, deceit, and malignity. But God doesn't just condemn those who commit such things. He also condemns those who have pleasure in them that do them. That's a whole lot of people in America today. And even the downfall of Harvey Weinstein, the more details people can get about what happened in print, it seems like the more interest there is in those types of stories. The trumpet brief concludes, can we turn around and expect only blessings? How shall I pardon you for this? God asks through one of his prophets in Jeremiah 5. Your children have forsaken me and sworn by them that are no gods. When I had fed them to the full, then they committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. They were as fed horses in the morning, every one neighed after his neighbor's wife. Shall I not visit you for these things? Says the Eternal. And shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Pretty, pretty strong words. And again, it's easy to point the finger at one person who obviously is very corrupt and did a lot of terrible things. But what about the movies? We just haven't heard much about that. Make sure you check out this trumpet brief. Really important. They all are. Get them for free at thetrumpet.com. You can sign up for them there. That's all the time we have for today on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program that's coming up. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, which is on the way shortly. For myself, Dwight Falk, have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.